Well, South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission has been the model for, you could say, far too many societies where a history of violence and human rights abuses beyond the scope of what the standard system of assigning responsibility and rendering justice can handle. The list of countries that have tried the truth and reconciliation process runs from Bosnia to Rwanda to Chile and Argentina and even Iraq, where in 2004 there was some talk of using that method to reconcile the Sunnis and the Shiites. They may come to that yet. But what about here at home? In the USA, where we still do struggle to overcome the legacy of slavery and Jim Crow and other racial discrimination. Well, University of Maryland law professor and civil rights attorney Sherilyn Ifill has a new book called On the Courthouse Lawn, Confronting the Legacy of Lynching in the 21st Century, in which she calls for a similar process here, now, before the last of the eyewitnesses to the worst of Jim Crow abuses is gone. She joins us now from Baltimore. Professor Ifill, welcome to WNYC. Hello from New York.
Hello from Baltimore.
Your book, first of all, looks in depth at two lynchings in one region of Maryland, the Shore, and extrapolates from there to suggest how racial injustice could be addressed. So let's start, as you did in the book, with these specific lynchings in that particular spot. Tell us a little bit about that region of the country and why you started there.
Well, the Eastern Shore of Maryland is in many ways very different than the rest of the state. I first arrived there in the mid-1990s to work on a civil rights case. I was representing a small black community that was challenging the location of a state highway that was being run directly adjacent to the community. And it was while I was working on this case that I first heard about the lynchings that took place in 1931 and 1933. In 1931, Matthew Williams was lynched on a Friday evening in December. He was a young black man who had been accused of shooting his boss, who owned a lumber yard. His boss was a white man named D.J. Elliott, very much respected by both blacks and whites in the community. And Matthew was accused of shooting him and then being shot by the man's son. And so Matthew Williams was in the hospital in a straitjacket with a head wound when a mob came and dragged him from the hospital five blocks to the courthouse and hung him on the courthouse lawn and then dragged his body to the black section of town and there burned it. Mm. It's estimated that between 500 and 1,000 people witnessed the lynching of Matthew Williams that night. 2 years later, about 15 miles away, George Armwood was lynched. George Armwood was a laborer, a field worker, young African-American man who was accused of assaulting an elderly white woman. He was first taken to Baltimore City for safekeeping, and that was the practice in that region. On the Eastern Shore, if a black man was accused of a violent crime against a white person, it was known that mob violence was a possibility, and so they were taken to Baltimore City, to the Baltimore City jail, to save their lives. And he was taken to Baltimore City. But the next day, on the order of either the sheriff or the local judge, he was ordered to return to the Eastern Shore. And he was brought back to the Eastern Shore, arrived about 2 in the morning, and by 8 o'clock that night, he had been dragged from the jail by a crowd estimated at approximately 2,000 who used battering rams to knock down the door of the jail, dragged him from the second floor of the jail, dragged him several blocks, hung him, and then brought him back outside the courthouse in the town of Princess Anne and burned him. And in addition, there were several near lynchings that happened in that period, too, between 1931 and 1933. When crowds gathered and tried to lynch, in fact, went from jail to jail looking for black men accused of crimes against whites on the Eastern Shore. In those other cases, the black men were successfully taken to Baltimore City, and so they lived to stand trial.
500 people, 2,000 people taking part in these instances. These were lynchings in the early 1930s, and in both cases, as you tell it, the victims were black men accused of assaulting whites, but while those crimes sparked the violence or the alleged crimes, they were in some ways a reaction to a prevented lynching, that of Ewell Lee. Tell us about that.
Yes, this period really began with the very gruesome murder of a white farm family in October of 1931. A white farm family, the mother, the father, and two daughters, were shot to death in their home. It's believed that the murderer was a black laborer named Ewell Lee, a 56-year-old man. who worked part-time at the farm of this family. And that was kind of the case that set things off. I should point out, however, that mobs assembled and went looking for Yul Lee as soon as it was determined that he was the likely murderer. Yul Lee was taken to Baltimore City, and not only did he survive to stand trial, he had two trials. He was represented by a lawyer from International Labor Defense, a communist-affiliated organization. This was the same organization that was representing the Scottsboro Boys. And his lawyer, a white Jewish lawyer named Bernard Aides, came to represent him. In fact, when Bernard Aides came to the Eastern Shore on behalf of his client, he was almost lynched and vowed never to return to the Eastern Shore. He successfully petitioned for a change of venue to have the trial heard in another part of the state in Towson, Maryland. Mm-hmm. And when Yul Lee was tried and convicted there, his lawyer successfully had the conviction overturned when it was determined that in Towson, Maryland, which this is not on the Eastern Shore, blacks were not serving on juries. In fact, there was no evidence that any black person had served on a jury in the prior 25 years. This was a violation of, obviously, the federal constitution and the violation of a Supreme Court decision called Strouder versus West Virginia that had come down in 1886 that said that denying blacks the right to serve on juries violated the constitution. And so he was given a second trial. He was convicted again this time. There were still no blacks on the jury, but there were blacks in the veneer of jurors that could have been selected. Mm-hmm. And he was convicted and he was executed in Maryland. And he was executed about 10 days after George Armwood was lynched.
Hmm. Why do you think that we need to go back to these stories now, except as a matter of history? Nobody thinks we should return to that system of non-justice. Why raise it now and write a book proposing a South African-style Truth and Reconciliation Commission for today in the United States?
Yeah. Brian, I think that's a great question. And the truth is that what inspired me to write this book was how deeply disturbed I became at discovering the power that these lynchings still had over these communities. And by these communities, I mean both the black and the white community. And that lynching was such a powerful event, and it elicited such fear and shame that it produced a cover of silence, not only in the black community, but in the white community. And it froze in place a kind of relationship that I discovered still was very much present when I went to litigate cases in the 1990s. And this is what really I found so disturbing, and that's why I talk about the legacy of lynching, that I believe that these events were so horrific in so many ways that blacks and whites became frozen in their relationships to one another. And this became quite apparent to me during the time that I was there. I talk in the book about this region as well and how, for example, in this entire region, although Maryland, you know, is regarded as a progressive state and really in many ways was the cradle of much of the civil rights work that culminated in Brown versus Board of Education. Mm-hmm. Thurgood Marshall is from Baltimore. The early cases of Thurgood Marshall and Charles Hamilton Houston were tried here. The University of Maryland Law School was the first and successful test case striking down segregation in higher education. And so Maryland was regarded as this tremendously progressive state. And yet this region almost was not a part of that. It's as though it existed unto itself. Now, part of that was about geography. It's a region that's separated by the Chesapeake Bay. And before the Bay Bridge was built in 1956, it took a long time to get out to the Eastern Shore. But it's also true that these events caused the white community to close ranks and turn inward because of the condemnation they received from Baltimore when the lynchings happened. It held the blacks there in a position totally disconnected from the kind of progressive action that was happening among blacks in Baltimore and other parts of the state. And so it really left this community essentially decades behind. And I think that even in their relationships with one another, in how blacks regard whites and the care of with which that relationship is maintained in a kind of frozen position, is very much a remnant of this history of violence.
So,
and this is
saying,
not the only community.
So you're saying that even generations later, these lynchings resonate differently in the white communities and the black communities.
Oh, no
that
question.
Even rejecting lynchings now in the white communities, they process them as a matter of history in a much different way than the black communities. That leaves the two still separated and isolated.
Yes. In fact, I mean, I talk about this in the book. It's not just that whites have difficulty talking with blacks about the lynchings. Whites have difficulty talking with one another about the lynchings. Mm-hmm. I tell a story in the book about a white woman who tries to tell the story of the lynchings to one of the historical societies in the town where Matthew Williams was lynched. And this was a group of her friends, and these were not, these were actually quite the elite set of the community, judges and historians and so forth. And she was shunned for years for making this presentation about this lynching. And this presentation happened in the late 1980s. And I talked with her in 2004. She said she was shunned for years and that it still hurts her, that some people never spoke to her again because she dared to broach the subject. And what also really surprised me, Brian, was when I began to talk with blacks about the lynchings, they would describe them in such vivid detail, almost as though they had seen them. And several elderly blacks, at least certainly one, Edward Taylor, told me that until he was a grown man, he thought he had seen the lynching of Matthew Williams. That's how vividly his father had described it to him. And it was only when he became older and saw the date of the lynching that he realized he wasn't even born then. So blacks really had a handle on it, and it was a defining event for them. But when I was in the white community, I would talk with whites, and they would have this kind of vague sense that, yes, a lynching happened, but, you know, we've heard that all the people were from out of town. They were all foreigners. And yet, you know, in the case of Matthew Williams, by my calculation, at least a tenth of the white community witnessed the lynching. Mm-hmm. And if you read the newspaper's accounts from that period, you discover it was shopkeepers and law students and newspaper publishers were all there and witnessed this lynching.
My guest on WNYC is University of Maryland law professor and civil rights attorney Sherilyn Ifill. She has written a book called On the Courthouse Lawn, Confronting the Legacy of Lynching in the 21st Century. And listeners, we can take your phone calls. What do you think of this idea of truth and reconciliation commissions here to deal with America's history of racism? Would you take part? 212-433-WNYC. Let's hear from listeners, both black and white. What would a New York commission explore, even if we don't have the same kind of history exactly as in the officially segregated South? Call us at 212-433-WNYC. 212-433-9692 or email brianlehrershow@wnyc.org. Maybe someone listening is from one of the southern communities where lynchings took place and have your own experience about memory or anything else pertaining to them. But while the calls are coming in, Professor Ifill, why don't you walk us through your three organizing principles for what a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, American style, would look like. You say they should be organized locally instead of a national commission, first of all. Talk about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is, you know, I can't emphasize enough the principle that I think is so critically important, that these initiatives have to be locally generated. I can remember when President Clinton called for a national conversation on race. And while, you know, in many ways it was a lovely idea, I think it's just really quite impossible to imagine having a national conversation on race. You know, in fact, much of the legacy of this kind of violence, of racial terrorism, really was experienced locally. And the possibility of reconciliation and reparation is also, I think, local. And that is that it is the local community that is invested, I think, or most invested in trying to find a way through the frozenness, trying to find a way through the silence. If you care about your community, if this is where you intend to raise your children, if this is where you intend to live, if this is where you work, then you have an investment that's different than the investment of anyone from the outside.
It's not
just a political investment, but a personal investment in the future of that community.
Right. It's not an abstraction. Your second principle is that dialogue is important. And does that mean instead of just testimony? What do you mean by dialogue?
Well, I think that we tend to think that when we're going to talk about race, it's going to look like the big town hall meeting that we've sometimes seen. And I try to emphasize that conversations are essential. You know, Paul Rusesabagina, who was the man about whom the film Hotel Rwanda was written and who talks quite a bit about his own country in Rwanda, you know, says that words are the most powerful tools of all. And he says that we must engage in the conversation that never ends. And this is something I think is quite true, but also quite troubling for Americans to deal with. Americans always want to know, when are we going to be finished with this? When are we going to be finished with this? Well, the first thing is we certainly can't be finished with it before we start. So one of the things we do have to start to do is be prepared to have candid, open conversations about race and recognize that they're conversations. Some conversations are just within the Black community. I mean, one of the things I explore in the book is that the Black community's response to lynching was not monolithic. You had some people who said we have to go along to get along. You had some people that were more resistant and more active. And that's produced its own legacy in our community. There are conversations that have to happen within the white community. There are conversations that have to happen within the church community, because the church community's response or lack of response to racial violence and racial terrorism is critically important and has a legacy of as well. There's a conversation that has to happen among institutions like the media and the role that the media played or plays in creating an environment in which racial violence can happen. So what I'm suggesting is that there are multiple conversations. There are conversations within families as young people discover the role that their parents or grandparents played in perpetrating or being complicit in racial violence and terrorism. So I guess I mean to suggest that we're not talking about one conversation. We're talking about many conversations, mm-hmm. and we're talking about multi-level, textured, and diverse conversations that have to happen.
My guest on WNYC, University of Maryland law professor and civil rights attorney, Sherilyn Ifill. Her new book is called On the Courthouse Lawn, Confronting the Legacy of Lynching in the 21st Century. And as you've been hearing, she proposes truth and reconciliation commissions for communities in the United States to deal with racial history and, for that matter, the racial present day in the United States. Our phone lines are packed, and we will talk to some of you and let some of you talk to Professor Ifill. When we come back, we'll also talk about her third proposal for what these truth and reconciliation commissions should come out with, and that is reparations. We'll get her definition of that. Stay with us, Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with University of Maryland law professor and civil rights attorney Sherilyn Ifill. Her new book, On the Courthouse Lawn, Confronting the Legacy of Lynching in the 21st Century, in which she proposes truth and reconciliation commissions for the United States. And Raphael in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Good morning, Raphael.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you.
I grew up on the Eastern Shore of Maryland in Kent County. And I live in Brooklyn now, and I just wanted to call in and, I guess, kind of reaffirm a lot of what I think your guest is saying, and that the conversation really needs to still happen and be more public. And I think the Eastern Shore of Maryland especially is a place where there needs to be concrete, active change in dealing with these issues of race and the classes and the relationships between blacks and whites in the United States and especially in Maryland.
Raphael, thank you very much. Robert in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Robert.
Hi, Brian. Hello, Professor Ifill. I'm very interested in this topic as a white South African who has lived in Brooklyn for almost 20 years now and has worked extensively across the United States on social justice issues, primarily dealing with poverty-related public health concerns. I also go back to South Africa frequently as part of my professional work, and I've had an opportunity to observe the way in which South Africa has developed post the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And I want to urge that part of what needs to be acknowledged in looking at South Africa as a potential model for this is to examine what I would actually characterize as a significant failure or follow-through in the aftermath of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa. And I understand you'll probably be getting to this when you talk about reparations. But I think that there's something about the model of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa that was enormously successful in opening up a dialogue for a time. But the ANC government has failed enormously in continuing that conversation through into the kinds of structural changes that are absolutely essential to ensure that a foundation is maintained over time for that kind of conversation to realize in substantive changes in the everyday lives of all people, not just the black South Africans who suffered enormously under apartheid, but the white South Africans who, to this day, maintain an enormous silence around their everyday culpability.
Professor Eiffel, he raises a number of really important points. Have you looked at the follow-through after the actual judicial part or dialogue parts of the Truth and Reconciliation Commissions in South Africa?
I thank Robert for his call, and I couldn't agree with him more. I think there's an instinct for people to regard these kinds of conversations as an event, as a cathartic event, rather than the beginning of a process. And one of the things I try to emphasize in the book is that rather than that, while there is an important part of the dialogue that's about individuals, there is a larger part of the dialogue that's about institutional complicity. And there's also a large part of the dialogue that has to be about beneficiaries and those who are silently complicit. And that is that it's not just about the principal actors, for example, in a lynching, but it's about the conditions that were created that permitted a lynching to happen. And that permitted it thereafter, for example, to go unpunished. It's all of the whites who were there, but who testified that I didn't recognize anybody in the lynch mob. It was those who refused to speak about it. It was those who refused to talk to the press about it. It was the local papers that refused to report on the lynching, and on and on and on. And part of what I think is the reason for the silence is precisely what Robert talked about in, among many whites, is the fear of addressing their role as beneficiaries of the fruits of white supremacy. And that is a critical part of the dialogue, but not just part of the dialogue. It's part of the dialogue with the eye towards reparation. And by reparation, I mean, what do we need in this community to repair the effects of this period in which this most violent tool of white supremacy was used in order to maintain dominion and control?
So take your
and that can mean a variety of things.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Well, you know, in the book, I talk about what I think has been a very impoverished conversation about reparations, that everyone thinks when we talk about reparations, we mean a check. And I don't mean to discount the validity of financial reparations where appropriate. In fact, one of my discoveries in doing the research was that after George Armwood was lynched, a petition was signed by 12 prominent lawyers from the region asking the governor of the state to impose reparations for lynching, that compel the counties to pay the lynching victim's family $10,000. And that petition was signed by a very young Thurgood Marshall as well as Charles Hamilton Houston. So the idea of reparations, financial reparations, is not new. But there are other forms of reparation as well. I mean, one of the things that struck me in looking at all of these different lynchings and near lynchings, including a near lynching in Kent County for Raphael, who called, who may enjoy this book because during this period there was a near lynching of a man named George Davis in Kent County, is that if you walk through all of these towns, there is no indication in the public space on the courthouse lawn, which is why I named the book that, that these events happened. And so one form of reparation is that, is the acknowledgement in the public space, the acknowledgement in the curriculum in the local schools, which does not include these events, the investigation of the lynchings, and the investigation of the underlying crime. Much of the shame in the black community among the families, for example, is around the fact that these black men were accused of crimes, and the assumption after the lynching was that they did it. There was never any investigation as to whether or not the black men actually committed these crimes. Well, if they didn't, there needs to be an investigation and an exoneration. There need to be tombstones where these men were buried, the shame around collecting the bodies of lynched victims. George Armwood was buried in a potter's field, in a pauper's field. All of these are forms of reparation, but the community has to identify what are the appropriate forms of reparation. But I mean to open up the conversation. And in the sense that Robert suggests in talking about South Africa, to keep that dialogue connected to action items and to keep it going forward into the future, not to presume that, you know, we have a TRC this year and now it's done, but that we're talking about creating a new community in which that community is undergirded by a shared history, a shared shared history that is now recognized from both the perspective of whites and the perspective of blacks.
Sherrilyn Ifill, my guest on WNYC, University of Maryland law professor and civil rights attorney, with a new book called On the Courthouse Lawn, Confronting the Legacy of Lynching in the 21st Century, which includes, as you've been hearing, the proposal of truth and reconciliation commissions for communities around the United States. Allison in Rutherford, you're on WNYC. Hello, Allison.
Yes, good morning. My experience is with my grandfather. He was from Columbia, Tennessee, and his best friend had been accused of flirting with a white woman, not raping her, not touching her, but simply flirting with her. And his best friend was lynched. He witnessed the lynching. His friend was taken to the woods and lynched, and he was hiding nearby and witnessed it. And immediately thereafter, he left Tennessee. He never returned, and he moved to California, and that's where my mother was raised and where I grew up. And it just changed our whole family destiny. And that story to this day is, as your guest has said, was so real to me, and it impacted how I viewed white people when I was growing up and how I viewed my place in the world. That lynching was very vivid.
Yeah, and what happens then is, let's suppose Allison, is in California, and she meets a white person, and they're talking, and they're having a lovely conversation, and the white person says, yes, my family's from Columbia, Tennessee. What a great town. I loved going there during the summers. You know, it's the country, and it's so beautiful, and it's so peaceful, and people are so friendly. And Allison has a very different story about Columbia, Tennessee, based on her grandfather's experience. What do we do with these two stories? I talked about this in the book, you know, with Hope, Arkansas. You know, President Clinton was from Hope, and you'll remember his film during the Democratic National Convention, you know, The Man from Hope, or A Town Called Hope, or whatever it was called. And it was this very gauzy, nostalgic view of Hope. But, you know, in the early 1920s, you know, Hope, Arkansas was kind of known as the lynching capital of the South for a little bit. There was a period, an 18-month period, in which there were two very public lynchings in which the bodies were left hanging from the water tower as you entered the town. And so it suggests to me that there's another hope. It doesn't mean that President Clinton's hope is not also true, but there is another hope. And where does that story get told? And how do we reconcile those two stories and create an integrated history of this town? I think that's critically important, that white supremacy continues in even the ownership of history, the ownership of public space, the ownership of a way of seeing a particular community. And as Allison points out, there's this other story that her grandfather carried up to California and that clearly changed his destiny and that changed the destiny of her family. And where does that story is a Columbia story, and it has a right, she has a right to tell that story, not just in California, but in Columbia.
Allison, would you want to participate in some kind of multiracial Truth and Reconciliation Commission process? Do you think that would change something for you and others from Columbia, Tennessee?
I think one of the problems is if you have a group like that meeting, it has to be somebody who has the spirit of reconciliation within them already. And that's the person that you don't need to reach.
Professor Ifill, what do you think about that?
So I actually disagree with that. I disagree with that, Allison. I think that that many people discover on the journey that they have a spirit of reconciliation. For example, one of the things that I discovered was the way in which white children who witness lynching actually want to talk. And when I say white children who witness lynching, I mean they were in the crowd, they were brought there by their dad, or they were brought there by an uncle, or they happened to be on the street. That many of them, I mean, we know that some participated, but others have a fair amount of confusion. They also were silenced. It was clearly something never to be discussed. But, you know, they're elderly now, and they actually want to talk. Likewise, you have the grandchildren of people who witness lynching. There's a wonderful book out by Cynthia Carr called Our Town, and she's a white reporter. And she writes about her journey once she discovers that her grandfather is in the crowd picture of that famous lynching in Marion, Indiana. And she talks about this journey that she goes on in this process. And Marion participated in a truth and reconciliation process as well. So I think that we underestimate the possibilities of people who develop a spirit of reconciliation. I talked about this woman who made the presentation, as I told you before, the Historical Society, and what happened to her and her friends, and this palpable pain that she felt at being rejected as a white woman in that community by other whites. This is not a story I would have known about had I not begun to probe this and had I not tracked her down. And so I think that we sometimes underestimate whether or not people on the journey will discover that they actually do want to participate and do want to try and find a way to make sense of the conflicting messages that America sent, whites as well as blacks. In fact, I think blacks had a more consistent message about what the very complexity of America. Whites very often got a very small slice of the story and were left to kind of reconcile the pieces that don't fit. I'm more optimistic, I think.
Before I forget, I should mention that Professor Eiffel will be reading here in New York on Saturday at 4 at the Human Bookstore in Harlem. That's Frederick Douglass Boulevard between 124th and 125th Streets, Saturday at 4. So judging from our response on the phones and in our inbox, a lot of you might want to turn out to that. And before you go, we've been talking mostly about the South, but here's an email that says New York City was the most active port of entry for the slave trade in the 18th century. There's a lot to talk about right here. So, Professor Eiffel, what about New York City, a northern city without the Jim Crow history, but with plenty of other racial history?
I think every place has its story to tell. You know, if some of you may know that Brown University, one of the elite institutions of the United States located in Rhode Island, recently completed its report on Brown's association with slavery. The report was ordered by the president of Brown, the first black woman president, Ruth Simmons, 2 years ago. And, you know, it's a fascinating report and something worth reading. I mean, one of the things that's talked about is, you know, the role of the North in profiting from the slave trade, in profiting from slavery. One of the things in the report that stunned me, for example, is that the basic slave uniform, the broadcloth that was used for the slave to create the what was essentially the slave clothing that plantation owners would purchase, the rough-hewn clothing for their slaves, was manufactured in Rhode Island, right? It was manufactured in the North. And so there were thoroughgoing businesses in the North that profited from the slave trade, no question about it. So I think every place has their story to tell. There are incidents of, you know, police violence and abuse. There are, of racial police violence and abuse. There are incidents of racial conflicts within communities, certainly in New York. I grew up in New York, so I'm well aware of them. There is no place, I think, that's immune. I try to address this question of lynching because there is a particular silence that I discovered in my years as a civil rights lawyer working in communities throughout the South. That lynching produced in those communities. But lynching itself was not limited to the South either. I just talked about Marion, Indiana, Duluth, Minnesota, Utah, Illinois. There were lynchings all over the United States, certainly predominantly in the South,
and
not exclusively.
Yes, and the need for truth and reconciliation go way beyond the act of lynchings to so many things from our racial history.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I use this as a case study, but it certainly, it seems to me, can be analogized to any number of other pieces of the tools of white supremacy that continue to resonate in those communities.
Sherilyn Eiffel is a professor at the University of Maryland School of Law and a civil rights lawyer. Her new book is On the Courthouse Lawn, Confronting the Legacy of Lynching in the 21st Century, published by the Beacon Press. And again, Professor Eiffel will be reading on Saturday at 4 at the Human Bookstore in Harlem on Frederick Douglass Boulevard between 124th and 125th Streets. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up in a minute, JetBlue and its proposal for a passenger's bill of rights. Will it transform the airline industry beyond the one airline? Stay with us.